The treaty was signed in 1964, and as Steve Jackson reports, several tribal officials are asking that they be included in negotiations to renew the treaty.
The Columbia River Treaty of 1964 sets down how power generation and flood control will be handled between the U.S. and Canada. But Native American tribes were left out of those negotiations. Colville Tribal Councilmember John Cyrus says the main issue is the plight of endangered salmon was not considered when the treaty was signed. He says they hope to change that by issuing a declaration that calls on the U.S. State Department to include tribes in the implementation of a new treaty, as well as managing the river to deal with a changing climate.
How this new Columbia River Treaty can be managed to include ecosystem-based function, and that, you know, it's healthy for not just tribes, but, you know, all the area's people, all the, you know, salmon, animals, all those things.
Cyrus says there's new emerging technology that can be used to help migrating salmon that have been prevented from gaining access to the upper Columbia River, especially after Grand Coulee Dam was completed in the early 1940s. The U.S. and Canada have an option to renegotiate the 50-year-old treaty this fall. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
Tribal representatives took the first steps last week towards establishing the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, the group intends to push for co-management of salmon stocks and more direct involvement for tribal fishermen.
The river is currently split between state and federal jurisdiction. Mark Leary from the Paiute explained when you cross a line at Aniak, the regulations drastically change.
It's madness.
Leary says that inconsistency is one reason for tribes on the Kuskokwim to form the commission. Myron Manning is the president of the Association of Village Council Presidents and says co-management is due because tribal members bear the brunt of conservation measures.
They go back to our people and say, you guys should follow this rule and regulation and you should cooperate. No, that's no longer the case. If we're going to come up with the rules and regulations that we're going to work on, let's do it at an equal level with the state as well as the federal government so that we are protecting the rights of our people to hunt and fish.
Organizers envision a structure in which the commission works in tandem with federal and state agencies. Draft federal legislation would authorize agreements in which the commission formulates management plans and has a direct role in run assessments, test fishing, and sharing local knowledge. Wayne Morgan is from Aniak.
No more push sub to side, you know, by state or federal, saying, thank you for your comment, AVCP. Thank you for your comment, Tribal Council. We'll take that into consideration.
Another pillar of the plans calls for reducing bycatch of king salmon in Bering Sea trawl fisheries and setting steep fines for bycatch. Next steps include creating a 10-person steering committee to further organize and bring together tribes to formally establish the commission. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The United South and Eastern Tribes Organization is honoring retiring leader of the Porch Band of Creek Indians, Buford Rowland, who's been involved in tribal affairs for more than 50 years. Improving health care has been one of his priorities. USET recognized the chairman this week at its semi-annual meeting. In June 1924, Congress extended American citizenship to all American Indians born in the U.S. with the Indian Citizenship Act. Native people had previously received citizenship through marriage, military service, and land allotments. It was also granted to some tribes during treaty making. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
California's Humboldt State University has a part-time 42-month online Master of Social Work program emphasizing decolonizing work in rural and indigenous communities. January 2015 semester applications accepted in August. Humboldt.edu/social work.
National Native News brings you information from around Indian country and the world. To do this, we rely on financial support from organizations like yours. Find out how to reach our listeners while also supporting this program by visiting nativenews.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 5 minutes after the hour here on a Juneau afternoon, and I've been joined here in the studio by Mr. Joe Carson. How are you today, Joe?
Hey, Scott. Doing good.
Thank you so much for coming down today. And you are going to be participating in this Thursday's Writer Showcase.
Yes, I will be.
Well, I guess I should say you sort of have already participated in it, though, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm going to have the luxury of, for once, sitting back and watching someone else read one of my stories. I'm looking forward to that. I've never really done that before.
Yeah, so for you listeners who aren't familiar with Writer Showcase, it's a show that we're doing at 360 as part of our Arts at 360 for 360 North television programming. And we've modeled the program after selected shorts on NPR where they get famous people and actors to read short stories and essays. And so Joe is one of the writers who will be there this Thursday night at 7 p.m. is when cameras roll, 6:30 is when doors open. He'll be joined by other Alaskan writers like James Sweeney, a climber and writer out of Anchorage, and Martha Amore, a teacher and writer out of Anchorage, and another local here from Juneau, Kirsha Scandes, new to the scene as a writer. So pretty exciting to have those writers involved. And then we have some great actors like Donnie Gott, and Ryan Conroe will be reading your piece, and Roblin Gray Davis will be reading James Sweeney's piece. So pretty exciting night. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to it.
So, Joe, you're a writer. You've lived in Alaska since when?
Boy, I first moved to Juneau in 1976, and then moved up to Fairbanks around 1979, and then about 7 years ago, I came to my senses and moved back to Juneau, and here I am.
Just for our nice weather down here,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, I got this weather doesn't bother me at all.
When did you start writing?
Oh, I've done it all my life. Yeah. I started probably when I was just a little kid. I'm just a natural, born storyteller, and I just can't help doing it. And I probably got really serious about it, I don't know, maybe about 15 years ago, maybe, something like that.
Okay.
And, I'd always been a writer.
Let's get back to that in a minute, but I know television show on Thursday is sort of timely because you are also doing some ebook releases and so you have some new material coming out, right?
Yes, they're going to be reading that story Sweet Sunny South, which is in my book Dining with Hitler and Hemingway, which is a collection of short stories, which is still available as a hard copy if you can find it in the bookstores or you can get it through Amazon, but it has been made into an ebook along with four other ebooks, which are now going to be available through Amazon. If you go to Joe Carson, that's with a K, Joe Carson, KARSON.com, internet style, you know, kind of run it together, lowercase. Or if you just Google me, that sounds like fun, Google me, it's just my name, Joe Carson, the way you normally would spell it, with a K. At Joe Carson Writers, Joe Carson Project, you can find the five books there, and there's something there to read for free. I'm always going to try to have something like that on there so you can get a sample. Plus, I think you can actually get some samples of the books, I think, before you buy the email, the ebook. And they're pretty good, pretty good price, cheaper than buying a book. So that should be...
No shipping?
It just comes
right to you?
Yeah, all you got to do is press a few buttons and you can get it in the comfort of your home or your tavern, your cell, wherever you abide, and read it on your own screen in your own...
So you're not going to read... Right now you have a piece for us. You're not going to read Sweet Sunny South. We're going to leave that to Ryan Conroe on Thursday night, who I heard him rehearse it. It sounds awesome, so that's going to be exciting. But this is something new. What do you have for us?
Yeah, well, I've been going back and forth here. I decided on a gloomy day like this, I think I'll read something that's just kind of lighthearted. This is the first couple of paragraphs from my story Conclave, which is in the new short story collection, which is going to be offered on Amazon now as an ebook. It's called from the collection called 17 Unicorns. This is one of the 17 stories, and it's called Conclave. Pope Ken I was still lying in state inside St. Peter's Basilica. Cardinal Lovano had just paid his last respects, and now he joined the other cardinals at San Damaso Courtyard, the lawn outside the palace where the new pope would reside. This was the second sede vacante, period between popes, in the past year. Ken's reign as Supreme Pontiff was brief by design, but the cardinal had hoped for a little more rest before returning to his Vatican duties. At their last conclave, the College of Cardinals had become hopelessly deadlocked and, following a time-honored procedure, elevated their eldest member to the throne of St. Peter. Ken, born Francis Kenneth Dolan, was 89 and thus became the first American pope. Despite the historic precedent, his six-month papacy was as brief and unremarkable as anticipated. Still, like all popes before him, Ken I brought a few harmless innovations to the Vatican. Replacing the helmets of the Swiss Guard with leather aviator caps bearing the Harley Davidson insignia seemed a harmless whim, as did transforming the sedia gestatoria, the pope's ornately carved mobile throne, into something resembling a dune buggy. No, these were minor deviations from tradition that the new pope would surely set straight. But it was in just this matter of electing his successor that Ken had chosen to truly assert himself. This was certainly his privilege. Though the ritual of holy conclave had been chiseled in stone, Vatican law allows that each pope may ordain specific instructions for the next election in his will. Ken had done so, and until the election, the deceased pope was still sovereign of Rome. Cardinal Lovano sighed and shook his head. Well, maybe Ken's instructions for electing the new pope would make things easier. He certainly hoped so. The typical squabbling and political intrigues of the last conclave had made the aging priest weary of the whole process. Extra omnes! Extra omnes! Everyone out! Cardinal Lovano listened to the command that for centuries has heralded the start of the secret conclave. He watched the Swiss Guard struggle with their billowing costumes as they shut the gate to St. Peter's Square. Funny, he was starting to like those new hats. The shadow of the enormous gate fell across the cardinal's bright red cassock. Dutifully, he wheeled his Il Fumo Deluxe charcoal grill to its assigned position in the courtyard. The chilly cook-off to select the next pope was officially underway.
Thanks, Joe.
What could go wrong there?
Right. So that piece right there is called Conclave?
Yes, it takes, as you can see, in the Vatican. I was thinking, I wrote that during the time when they were selecting the new pope, and I heard someone in the church say that they figured it was preordained by the divine who was going to get selected, so I figured since it didn't make any difference anyway, why not have it be fun to select the pope? And who doesn't like a chili cook-off, right?
So, right.
Just thought that would be kind of fun.
What are some of the other subjects in your collection? You said it's called 17 Unicorns, is that right?
Yeah, I call it 17 Unicorns because I've often compared fiction with a unicorn because it's an imaginary thing made up of real parts, it's really hard to write anything, no matter how fanciful, that doesn't come from your experience. And like a unicorn, if you had never experienced a horn or a horse, you could not. There's no way that you could even imagine a unicorn. So, and that's one reason. Well, that's besides. I thought it was a provocative title. I've called my new collection of short stories 17 Unicorns." Of course, I've let the cat out of the bag now. People, if you're expecting unicorns, sorry, no unicorns, just stories.
And
there will be some things that are fanciful, though, including there's one genuine fairy tale. It's a contemporary fairy tale, very much in the mode of Grimm Brothers fairy tale. It's rather...
Where's the setting?
It's dark.
Is it?
Yeah, like most of the Grimm Brothers fairy tales are, so...
And you said you started writing as a kid, and you probably got professional about it, 15, 20 years ago, something
15,
like that?
20 years ago I started. I'd been taking notes, and first started sending things out and getting kind of serious about, you know, really, really working on the craft of writing about 20 years ago.
And do you write mostly fiction or nonfiction?
I've worked as a journalist. I've written some nonfiction. As a matter of fact, the one thing to read that's going to on my website is an essay. But I like writing short fiction is really what I like to write. That's my main thing. Some of it very short.
And what is it about that you like the most?
Well, I like the challenge of writing short fiction. I like dense writing where things sort of happen. I mean, not long, like in novels, you get long stretches of expository prose. I figure, mm-hmm. I mean, everyone knows what a tree looks like. I like getting my characters in there and kind of mixing it up. And that just sort of worked out that way. I tell people that my stories are almost more like discoveries and inventions because they come to me whole, which I think it's probably that way for other short fiction writers. I get the whole thing, the beginning, the middle, and the end. As a matter of fact, very often the end is what comes first, and I find myself writing towards that end. I mean, novelists talk about how they'll start writing and they're not really sure how it's going to end up, but I can't imagine that as a short story writer. I always kind of have the thing under control. Hopefully.
Speaking of short stories and your work and under control, this Thursday we'll be hearing Sweet Sunny South by Ryan Conroe. Can you give us a teaser about this piece?
Well, I would guess it would have to fall under that standard category of a coming-of-age story. It's about a young man who leaves his home in the north and travels down to totally new territory in the south and has some adventures there, and I'm not going to tell too much more about it than that, except, again, this is definitely a unicorn. I have this problem, so a lot of people can't distinguish in my writing what's memoir and what's fiction. This is fiction. there's a lot of experience in there, but it is fiction. I have to say that because some of my characters are really kind of nasty people. I'd hate to thank anybody, but this person isn't, and you get to follow his adventures in the sweet sunny South, which doesn't turn out to be exactly what he was expecting. But it has a happy ending.
And again, Ryan Conroe will be reading that this Thursday night at 7 p.m. as part of Writer Showcase. Joe, I'm sure you're going to be there looking forward to it.
Yeah,
I'll be there
very
hosting.
Very much looking forward to that.
And I'm pretty sure Kirsha Scandes is going to be there. And like I said, Allison Holtkamp will be there, and she'll be reading Kirsha's piece. Donnie Gott will be there, and she's reading Martha Amore's piece called Half Hitch. Kirsha Scandes' piece is called Closing Shift, by the way. And Roblin Gray Davis is going to kick off the night by reading a piece by James Sweeney called The Hard Way about climbing El Cap in Yosemite. It's a really exciting story, so looking forward to that as well. Admission is free. Come see some of these writers and these actors. See what I was thinking about it today, Joe. It's interesting. So they, you know, here are these actors whose art is to perform, and here's your art, which is to write, and then we get to put the two together and see where it goes. So it's going to be pretty exciting.
Absolutely. Like I said, I'm very much looking forward to this, and I know Ryan's going to do a great job.
Yeah, so please come on down. Again, that's 7 p.m. this Thursday night in At 360. Joe, thank you so much for your time today. Real quick, what's your website called again for your new ebook?
Yes, if you just go to joecarson.com, that will bring you to the Joe Carson Project, which has 5 ebooks on it and something to read for free. That's Carson with a K. So happy reading.
Great, and we'll see you on Thursday night, Joe.
Yeah,
thanks.
You bet.
This is something that's almost as bad as one banjo. Possibly worse. Where I first saw the light, to the sweet sunny south, take me home. Till the mockingbirds sing me to rest every night. Why was I tempted to move? I think with regret of the dear home I left, of the arms that sheltered me there. Of wife and of dear ones of whom I'm bereft, for the old place again do I stand.
With the Juno Afternoon here at about 20 minutes after the hour. Scott Burton, your Tuesday host, and I've been joined in the studio by members of the upcoming Student Symphony. They'll be playing this Friday at the Jack at 7 p.m. Welcome, Kristen, Maggie, and Katie.
Thank you.
How are you all doing today?
Good.
Good. Pretty good.
So let's go. Why don't we start with you, Kristen? Why don't you tell us what you play in the symphony and how you're involved and how long you've been playing that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. We were just trying to figure out how long we've been in the symphony. So the Juno Student Symphony is a community orchestra for people of all ages. We've had kids as young as 7 or 8 in it. We've had very elderly people, and it's just fun, you know, like if you're an adult and if you haven't played your instrument for maybe a really long time and you'd like to brush up or you'd like to try a new instrument, but we just really have a lot of fun. I took up the violin just about 5 or 6 years ago, and we were just trying to figure out how long we've been playing it. It's just about 5 years between us.
You and Katie are about the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Katie, what instruments do you play?
I play percussion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you get to play that big drum sometimes?
Yeah. Oh, the timpani, the bass drum, the cymbals, the vibraphone, all the little bells, all the triangle, all the little things that are in there.
Nice. And Maggie, you also play some percussion, right?
I play percussion and a lot of piano during this concert.
Ooh. That seems like that would be stressful. Well, actually, both percussion. What if you hit the big drum at the wrong time?
That poses a problem.
That happens sometimes.
It does.
But I was going to say the piano, too. Seems like some pressure with that.
Yeah, it basically consists of playing the violins part and the brass sections part at the same time.
Whoa.
But it's fun. It's different than, like, playing the others because you are playing everything, but it's almost easier in a way because you have been trained that way when you play piano, I guess.
Maggie's a pretty good pianist.
Yeah, she's...
Yeah.
Thank you. Sure.
And what are some of your favorite parts about... About how many folks would you say are in the symphony?
A lot.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's people that come and go, but we probably have 40 or so, 40, 50. Yeah.
Yeah, and what's the best part of it for all of you? Anyone?
Well, it's just really fun. I mean, it's fun to play with kids. It's fun to play together. And, you know, it's always a good chance to improve your musicianship. And we have whole families that play in it together. And it's just a really great community experience. And I can tell you a little bit about our program this time.
Yeah, please do. Is it Broadway?
What do we call it? Broadway favorites. And so we have some really challenging pieces for us, but they're really fun. We're doing Phantom of the Opera.
Ooh.
Highlights from Wicked.
Fun.
Pirates of Penzance, a Gershwin medley, a Big Apple New York medley. So a lot of fun music.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And you, is Tyree, it's Peeny, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your new conductor, right?
Yep, he's been our conductor for just this previous year. So Rick Trostel handed over the baton to him last fall, and he's been doing a really great job. And, with the music selection, it's just been really fun.
Oh, good. Good. And so you all will be playing this Friday at 8 p.m. 7 p.m., excuse me, at the Juno Arts and Culture Center?
Right. I guess we're following, it's Food Truck Friday, I guess, and I guess the Thunder Mountain Big Band is going to play before us, but it's 7 o'clock, all that is over, and so if you're still there and you had dinner, you can come see us play at 7 at the Jack.
Well, that sounds perfect.
We're also playing at the State Office Building at noon.
Oh.
Or a little afternoon. After,
on Friday?
Yeah, after the organ concert. Yeah.
Oh, great. I'll write that down as well. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. And then, let's see, you're going to have a Pops concert, it looks like, maybe this summer at some point. I think I saw on your website.
We may not know too much about that, but it's coming in August, the last bit of July and August. And those Pops concerts go fast. They rehearse a lot all at once, and then they go for a little tour to, I think they're going to Hoonah this time. Yeah.
And you get to travel, too, so that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, is there anything else that any of you would like to add?
Well, I just would like to, I would just want to say, you know, if you've been thinking about, picking up an instrument and you haven't played in a long time, or you would just like to have the experience of playing with the group, it's a really great place to start. So I would just invite you to, and you can look at the website, it's junostudentsymphony.org, and there's registration forms and a little bit of information there.
Okay, yeah. JunoStudentSymphony.org.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, again, that concert is 7 p.m. at the Jack this Friday, right after Food Truck Friday in the Big Band. A free concert as well. Is this one free?
Ours is pay as you can, but it's, you know.
Right? Right? And also a concert after the Brown Bag Lunch at noon at the SOB.
Yes.
So a big Friday for all of you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for coming in, Maggie, Kristen, and Katie. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Let's get Bird Note here.
This is Bird Note. For more than a decade, Dr. Henry Sears has been restoring native habitat on his farm near Chesapeake Bay. Why has he dedicated himself to this work?
Because I've lived long enough to understand the tragic consequences of the last 65 years of changes to the rural and agricultural lands of Maryland's Eastern Shore. I've seen the results on the environment caused by changes in farming practices and development. My generation has been witness to the destruction of habitat, leading to the loss of many of Maryland's iconic species, starting with the canvasback duck, the terrapin, oysters, and now the northern bobwhite quail.
Dr. Sears wanted to find out if, after 250 years of alteration, native grasslands could be brought back for the benefit of birds, plants, and other animals. Within a month of the initial restoration, hundreds of grasshopper sparrows moved in. Bobwhite quail numbers rose dramatically. Dick sissels, an extremely rare bird in Maryland, appeared the following year. Now, 15 years into the project, Dr. Sears reminds us that, although rewarding, habitat restoration is a complex and long-term undertaking.
These things are much more complicated than is usually perceived. For what we're doing, it may be very successful, but it's going to require a tremendous amount of ongoing work. It's not start it and let it go. Nature doesn't work that way.
To see pictures of the restoration in process, come to our website, birdnote.org.
Join the Juno Symphony on Saturday, June 7th for Top Hats and Tails, a farewell banquet for conductor Kyle Wiley Pickett. Set under the lush canopy of the Glacier Gardens rainforest, it will feature live chamber music and a four-course dinner. Catering provided by Shea Alaska, Specialty Imports, Alaskan Brewing Company, and Heritage Coffee. Dinner and ceremony begins at 7 p.m. Tickets available by calling the Symphony office at 586-4676. Reserve your seat today. This message brought to you by the Juno Symphony.
And it is about 30 minutes after the hour here on a Juno afternoon on Tuesday, June 3rd, 2014. I've been joined in the studio here with author Deb Vinas. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you back in today.
Nice to be here.
And also Juno Library Program Coordinator Beth Weigel.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anytime. So, Deb, you are going to be participating in a family night tonight at the library. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what do you have in mind? What will you be reading tonight? I know you've written a wide variety of stuff.
I have, but we're going to focus tonight on a book that's particularly interesting to families in Southeast. It's called Totem Tale. And I'll talk a little bit about how a book is born, and we'll read the story. And if we have time, we might do one other Juno book, Black Wolf of the Glacier, which is a children's book about Romeo the Black Wolf.
Okay, well, let's get back to the writing in a minute, and those two books and your writing process and all that. But real quick, Beth, how about the nuts and bolts for tonight? Where and when, and what's the night look like and all that kind of stuff?
Right, so this is our first Tuesday family night, and we switch a little bit in the summertime. Over the course of the year, people are probably really familiar to coming to these family nights downtown with AEYC, the Association of Education for Young Children. But the library kind of takes on that role over the summer, and AEYC takes a little break and does some other things. So this is our first summertime family night, first Tuesday. Tonight we'll be at the Valley, and in the future we'll be at Douglas for the Tuesdays.
Okay, and it starts at 5:30 tonight.
5:30, we put out breads and spreads. I think maybe tonight we might have pizza, and we'll have some snacks, and the evening progresses to doing a little craft, and we've got some great totem coloring pages tonight that come from the book, and then we'll have Deb talk a little bit and entertain the kids and enlighten them on some of the great things she's done.
Yeah, and maybe go till 7-ish, somewhere in there?
At the very latest. Usually we're done mostly with the program by 6:30, and people linger, and yes, but definitely we'll be done by 7. So.
And if anybody doesn't happen to know, the Valley Library is in the Mendenhall Mall.
That's right, and it's good for all ages. That's why we call it Family Night.
Okay. So folks might hear from Totem Tale or Totem Tales. You might
Totem
read from
Tale,
that.
Yeah, Tall Story from Alaska. And Beth did ask me to bring some books in case people want to buy books. And I'm happy to sign books. A lot of times people have copies of these books already in their libraries. Happy to autograph those.
And the second book you mentioned is Black Wolf. And you said it's based on Romeo?
It is.
And you wrote this one?
I did.
Remind me where you live.
So I live now in Eagle River, just outside of Anchorage, but actually it's the library's fault that I wrote this book, because the last time I was in Juneau, I think it was 2010, I attended the memorial service for Romeo.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking to do a book on a true story, and I thought it's a little bit of a sad story, but kind of a challenge to see if that could be a book for kids, and it is now.
Oh, wow. It sounds interesting. And did you fictionalize it, or is it how?
So the way it's it's fictionalized, I did introduce a girl and her dog, but their interactions with Romeo are typical of the interactions that people like Nick Jans and others had with the wolf.
Okay. And what about Totem Tale? What's that book? What is that book about?
That's about a totem pole that comes to life. And then when the animals, the totems all have to go back onto their pole or something terrible is going to happen to them, they're going to get stuck in the land of in-between and never there, and they can't decide which order they want to be in, and they all want to be on top. That's their story problem. We'll talk about that tonight.
And so I suspect you'll do some readings, and then usually what happens after that, questions, interaction with the kids, what's that look like, Beth?
Well, it varies on the topic that we've got going on. Like I said, we'll have some time for them to color and play with the coloring sheets that she produced from some of the drawings. And I can't remember the name of the person who did the drawings.
Eric was
Eric,
it.
Right. Yeah. And so they can color in that and, you know, maybe make up their own little stories about, you know, what happens on their totem.
Okay. So it'll be interactive.
Definitely interactive.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. That's tonight at the Valley Library. It's family night. It's from 5:30 to 6:30. There's snacks. It's free.
Definitely free.
Reading from a couple great books by an Alaskan writer, Deb Benass. Anything else that either of you would like to add?
Just that I'm looking forward to meeting everyone tonight.
All right, Deb and Beth, thank you so much for your time. And let's see what old Garrison Keillor has to say today on Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 3rd of June, 2014. It's the birthday of poet Allen Ginsberg, 1926, Newark, son of Lewis, who was a poet, high school teacher, and Naomi, who was a communist and a paranoid schizophrenic. The boy was very close to his mother when she was in the grip of her delusions. He was the only one whom she trusted, and he often accompanied her to her therapy appointments. She spent much of his childhood in various institutions. He went to Columbia University to study law, but during his freshman year, he met Neil Cassady, William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, decided that he was a poet. In 1954, Ginsberg moved to San Francisco, where in October 1955, at the age of 29, he read his poem Howl at the Six Gallery, which made him famous. His mother died in 1956, and 2 days later he got a letter from her in the mail in which she had written, "The key is in the window, the key is in the sunlight at the window, I have the key." He wrote his poem in her memory, Kaddish, published in 1961. Allen Ginsberg, who said, "Poetry is not an expression of the party line. It's that time of night, lying in bed, thinking what you really think, making the private world public. That's what the poet does." It's the birthday of the romance writer Kathleen Woodiwiss, 1939, born Alexandria, Louisiana, whose first novel, The Flame and the Flower, published by Avon, sold 600,000 copies in 1972. Kathleen Woodiwiss changed the romance genre. Before, the novels had been pretty thin. Hers were often 700 pages long, heavily plotted, full of carefully researched historical detail and steamy sex scenes. And it's the birthday of Larry McMurtry, 1936, Wichita Falls, Texas. Raised in Archer City, about 80 miles from the town of Thalia, the setting for several of his novels, including the first, Horsemen Pass By, and also the last, Picture Show. Also the proprietor of an enormous bookstore, Booked Up, the name of it, in his hometown, Archer City, in four large buildings that used to house a car dealership. Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, Naming the Baby. When you are dreaming of the name, you are also dreaming of who they might be. They are invented in darkness under cloak of skin, and for the better part of a year are a swelling or a set of symptoms. The name books are like a box of chocolates, and when you open them, you see how many kinds there really are. There are names of people you have known and disliked, and names that make the wrong sounds, and names that suggest your child will be like everyone else's. There are names that turn your child into a character in a novel, and names that recall the time when your great-grandmother was young. Naming the baby is a way of dreaming about a creature who is almost but not quite. It is a way of imagining the soul of a person you are making but have not made. The name is the first way you see the baby, their title, the syllables that conjure a shape from the lantern. Naming the Baby by Faith Sheeran from The Empty House, published by Word Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that's been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
While smoking as a young man, I always thought I wasn't hurting anyone but myself. I was so wrong. Now at age 57 and diagnosed with severe COPD caused by my smoking, I live with the agony of knowing I may die early, losing time with my daughter and my precious relationship with my grandchildren. Avoid my mistakes and stop smoking today.
For support to quit tobacco, call Alaska's Tobacco Quitline at 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
It's 3:42, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 3rd, 2014. Annie Boutiver is going to be up next, but in the meantime, I thought we'd listen to a little Dave Grisman and Edgar Meyer. Thank you.
I'm Michael, a Tlingit and a native of Alaska. Some people in my tribe call me a ghost walker. That's because smoking gave me COPD. That's a disease that makes it harder and harder to breathe, and you can die. My COPD is so bad, my doctor gave me 5 years to live, if I'm lucky. My tip for you is to quit smoking now and live your life as a person, not as a walking ghost.
You can quit. We can help. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here. It's 3:47 on Tuesday, June 3rd, 2014. And I've been joined in the studio by Ann Buchiever. Thanks for coming back in, Ann.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this has been an exciting time for you, right, with the release
yes.
of this book?
Yes, it has.
So for those of you who aren't familiar, Ann's book, let's see, you released it May 1st.
Yes.
And it's called Bristol Bay Summer. And you've had an exciting month. You started with the AK Historical Library reading presentation. That's when we first talked. Since then, you went on the Hearthside Authors Tour out to Orca Point.
Yes.
I heard that was a lot
that
of fun.
Was gorgeous. Really, really beautiful. And the State Historical Library presentation was wonderful. It was kind of first time I got to really present my book and the background and how it came about, and it was well attended, and I mean, the only bad side was I had been up all night the night before delivering puppies. But that aside, it went really well, and it was a good experience for me.
And then this Friday, you'll be doing a book signing at Hearthside as part of First Friday.
Yes.
That should be fun as well. And then it looks like even on June 16th, you have another presentation at the Downtown Public Library?
In the Valley.
In the Valley, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So how has this been for you? I mean, the whole project of writing the book must have been really challenging and fun and all of that. And now the presentation, can you talk about those two processes and how they've been for you?
Sure. I got a 2-year leave from the school district to get an MFA in creative writing for children and young adults, and I attended the Northwest Institute of Literary Arts, which is a low residency program that I did a lot at home online, and then it required a couple residencies a year on Whidbey Island. And it was a wonderful, wonderful program. But my background in writing, other than being an English minor, was primarily plays that I wrote for my musical plays that I wrote for my students. And I really hadn't had that much formal education in writing, so it was kind of a shock. My first day of class, all these students pulled out their novels that they had been working on, and I hadn't even really considered writing a novel, but all at once that was what I was presented with, and it actually kind of just totally fell into place because I had had this experience over 30 years ago, and the first thing that we did was make an outline, and just the actual events that happened made a really nice story arc, and the outline just poured out because, I mean, I already kind of had this in the back of my mind for a long, long time. But it went from there to taking a good, 2 years solid, that was how long the program was, and submitting a chapter every week.
Wow.
It was an incredible challenge. And then, you know, it was my thesis. So, and then from there, I worked with an editor at a publishing company, Alaska Northwest Books, and underwent another couple of years of, you know, editing. By that time, I'd returned to the school district as a high school English teacher, so I didn't get to work on a chapter a week anymore.
Right. Yeah.
But so all in all, you know, it took 4 years to
wow.
really come to fruition. And so to go from all that working and criticism and, you know, critique groups to actually having people read it and hearing wonderful, you know, getting this wonderful feedback has been very rewarding.
And this beautiful product, Bristol Bay Summer. And, wow, how fun. How do you feel now that you're into this sort of post-celebration mode?
Well, I'm learning a lot about the publishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are a lot of advantages to working with a small publishing company. In case listeners haven't heard of Alaska Northwest Books, they are
a small company that was very well known for publishing children's books in Alaska, and for many years I was a part-time school librarian. They were the best books that I read for children, but they went bankrupt several years ago and have reformed under a larger company called Ingram Books, one of the largest book distributing companies in the world, and they're now out of Portland, Oregon. So, you know, the advantages of a small publishing company is they took a chance on a first-time writer, which mm-hmm. is hard to find a publishing company that will do that, and really worked with me and, you know, had an editor to work with me. So I'm very thankful for that, but I'm finding that the actual distribution is not so easy. It's hard to get your book distributed. It's hard to get your book reviewed. But, you know, it's coming along little by little.
Good. And do you have a selection picked out that you could read for us today?
I do.
Great.
For those of you that don't know anything about my book, it's called Bristol Bay Summer, and it is a coming-of-age Alaska adventure story starring the protagonist is Zoe Morley, who's 12 going on 13. She's an angry young teen in the beginning because her parents have been divorced and her mom made her and her little brother leave their dad in Colorado and come to crazy Alaska. And so her mom hooks up with a bush pilot boyfriend who decides to take them all out to Bristol Bay for the summer, where he's going to haul fish at a set net site and make his fortune, which means that Zoe has to live in a tent on the beach for the entire summer. So I'm going to read just a section from the very, very beginning of the book when she's first in the airplane that's going to take her to this far, far away place.
And how old is she again about
she's
here?
She's 12, and she'll turn 13 while she's out in the bay.
Oh, boy.
Zoe wiped her sweaty hands on her pants and hunched her shoulders up to her chin. She felt like throwing up. This was really happening. All her summer plans with her new best friend, Bethany, swimming at Jewel Lake, staying up late at the 4th of July concert on the park strip, and celebrating Zoe's 13th birthday at the new dance club. All those plans were gone. She and Bethany had planned it all out. They were going to take turns babysitting, and Zoe was going to use the money to fly to Colorado to find her dad. Only Bethany knew about that part, but Zoe was sure she could convince her mom when the time came. Instead, now she would be stuck in a tent in the middle of nowhere. Her mom had been firm, almost angry. Zoe, we are a family, and we are going out there together. And the letter she sent to her dad to see if she could stay with him returned to her stamped address unknown. How could that be? They had lived in that house her whole life until this last year. Where was he? Nearly a year had gone by without a single word from him, not even one letter. She was determined to find out why. But now this Bristol Bay summer plan was like a freight train that just kept coming, no matter how many things she tried to throw in front of it. Are you guys all right back there? Zoe's mom turned to look at them and burst out laughing. You look like real pioneers, all squeezed in there with everything you could possibly want for the next few months, off to a new world where, who knows, anything can happen. Where's the camera? She plunged an arm into her bag. Ready? Smile! Zoe didn't. Lassa, her dog, panted, so Zoe reached down and rubbed her head. Clear prop, Patrick yelled. He turned a key and the engine sputtered to life. Its roar overwhelmed even her thoughts. Then they were moving. Patrick wore a headset and spoke into a microphone, but with the noise, Zoe had no idea what he was saying. They taxied to the end of the runway. Patrick swung the plane into the wind and revved the engine. They rolled slowly, then faster. Zoe held her breath. The cabin was shaking so hard she worried the engine would fly right off the plane. All around her, things rattled and buzzed. Why hadn't they taken off yet? She dug her toes under the seat in front of her as if to lift it off the ground and watched the back of Patrick's head for any sign he might be in trouble. Faster and faster. Then the plane felt smooth and light, no more rattling, although the wings wobbled just a little. They were flying, but to where? Into some mysterious place Patrick called the real Alaska, a place she couldn't even imagine, a place her dad would never find.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Among other things, I liked the simile about the freight train. Bristol Bay was like a freight train. What was that one again?
Oh, well, a little prior to that in the story, you hear about how she said she was not going, and that was a very... she was very determined to stay that course, but she really had no choice. And her plans were gone with the wind. She just had to go along with her mom. She's only 12 years old.
And this is based a little bit on your experiences, but you do call it a book of fiction, right?
Yes, I do. I did take my own two kids to Bristol Bay in 1980, although at the time they were 4 and 6, and I was newly divorced and had a bush pilot boyfriend, and we were going to haul fish at a set net site. So the scene was very similar, and there were a lot of adventures, and it left a huge impression on me. I loved Bristol Bay, and I loved the people, and I really wanted to be able to portray that lifestyle that the fishermen have. There's something very romantic and really wonderful about it. So I tried to be, even though it's fictional, as accurate as I could with all the descriptions, the places. They go to Dillingham, they go to Naknek, and all those descriptions are really accurate. I actually went back out to Naknek a few years ago to do more research and to kind of refresh my memory because it had been a long time since I'd been there. Not that much had changed. I was kind of surprised.
And speaking of 12- and 13-year-olds, what's your target audience for this book?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. It's meant for middle-grade readers, mm-hmm. so ages, and I would say the upper end, ages 10 to 14.
Okay.
However, I keep having more and more adults that have read it and just loved it and said it was such a good read. So I think it's good for, you know, anybody 9 up.
Okay. Well, Anne, thank you so much for coming in today and sharing with us a selection from Bristol Bay Summer. If you would like a copy of this book, you can find it online and all that. But a better way would be to come to Hearthside Books this Friday. Probably, what time are you going to be down there?
Oh, I'll be there by 4.
Okay, and you can get a signed copy of this book.
Yes, I'd love to see you.
Yep, never too early to start thinking about birthdays, the holidays, summer, sitting on a beach somewhere. Great reading for all of that. Anne, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We had a banjo picker in this band who was a very deep person and multifaceted in his expressions in life. And he could give nicknames. He gave good nicknames. He gave one to Vassar here. Vassar smoked a pipe a lot, so he was called Clamp. Or Clem, depending. Me, of course, I was Red, or Panama Red. And John Conn played the bass, and both he and the bass were called Mule. And the mandolin picker...
Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Tune in tomorrow to a Juno Afternoon. Lori Scandling will be your host. She'll talk with Kyle Pickett about his years as the music director and conductor of the Juno Symphony. I wouldn't miss that. J. Kevin Birchfield will be here to highlight his new novel, Jungle Jingle. And we'll continue our Fish 101 series with Tom Rutecki from the National Marine Fisheries Auk Bay Lab. If you miss a Juno Afternoon or want to listen again, you can catch it and other local, statewide, national, and international news at ktoo.org. The weather for tomorrow looks mostly cloudy, highs around 61. No mention of rain. And Wednesday night through Friday, mostly cloudy, lows around 46, highs around 60, light winds. Again, no mention of rain. Friday night through Sunday, cloudy, chance of rain in the weekend, lows around 47, highs around 59. Here is All Things Considered.